Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Troubadour Talks. And today I have Rucka on the line or on the show, and we're going to talk about a story that we all know, but I have discovered through my own ignorance that I had not read. And I think probably a lot of you may not have read, but you know the story, and that's Peter Pan, the novel, not the play, not the movie, not the 2003 movie, not the 53 movie, not the, the 2019 Wendy movie, not the Disney Plus movie that's about to come out.
Not Hook.
Not Hook.
Although Hook, from all the ones that I surveyed, has the most to do with the book. Although that's probably not true. I think there's a 2000s movie.
I think 2003 is the most closely accurate to the book.
But then Hook is a movie about the book. It's not based on. It's about the book. So actually, I rewatched Hook after reading what is called Peter and Wendy. Actually, it was not even Peter Pan yet. It was Peter and Wendy in its original form. And the Hook, I was pretty impressed by. It was very. I'm sure we'll get to it once we talk about the book. Maybe I'll talk about how the different movies sort of relate to the book in or don't. So. Maybe we'll get to that a little later.
No, I think that's a good thing. There was also a play written by J.M. Barrie, which I think is what kind of made it into popular culture. And this was, so Peter and Wendy was, 1904, I believe is when it was originally published. And then I think several years later, I don't remember the date, he wrote a play. And this is the famous play that we're all familiar with that I think the Disney adaptation is a little bit closer to that. And then just in terms of I think as a kid, I've seen some kind of adaptation of, them coming in the window, like on a string, Peter flying around the room and those types of little things, which is of course in the book too.
The impression I get is that the play came first. That's what came first. And then the book was sort of taking the play and making it into a novel. So, you should watch the Johnny Depp movie. What's it called?
Neverland.
Finding Neverland. And it's really a moving story. And I think it's based on fact, more or less. The author, J.M. Barrie, he met this family, this group of orphans. Or their father was dead, their mother was still alive. He befriended the whole family, and by hanging around these kids, he sort of discovered his inner child and was inspired to create Peter Pan. And then tragically, their mother died as well, which he then he adopted the four boys. And it sort of gives you that summary in my book here. It tells you about the author, and it mentions that he met these kids, and then later adopted them. And I'm like, what? Since when do books tell you so much about an author's relationship, who he adopted and stuff like that? And then after watching that movie, I realized his friendship with these kids is a big part of what made Peter Pan come to be. So it's a wonderful movie, Finding Neverland. Definitely check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I watched that a long time ago. Okay, so thank you for correcting me. You're right. The 1904 was the play when I said first published, and then 1911 is the novel. You're right. Mm-hmm. I had it in reverse. So just so everyone's clear. Okay. So it's the play and then he did a novel on it. So, it's interesting to kind of hear the background of what inspired these things and what that might help us even in thinking about why he did it. And on this show, I've done this a lot where I talk about different interpretations of stories that we know, right? Like if we do a Frankenstein talk or, the novel, there have been a lot of plays in the 19th century. Almost right after its publication, there were plays of Frankenstein Monster. And then, of course, the movies. And there's just so many interpretations. And it's sometimes interesting to think about that. And it can also add to your enjoyment of a good story that you like, to kind of think about how other creators have taken it, maybe destroyed it, you think, or maybe they've made it better, or maybe they've done some cool things with it. So before we go into a little bit of that, Rucka, why don't we do a quick synopsis for everybody? Just to kind of remind them, if you haven't, this is going to have spoilers, but probably you know this particular plot summary to some degree. Yeah. So it's a little bit different with the book. Yeah, for sure. So what are the major things? It starts off in the Darling House in London.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of tells you the story basically sort of from the perspective of a child. So the dog is basically anthropomorphized, like their dog is described as like taking care of them. And their parents are described as childish, basically, like their parents are like silly and childish. So it's all sort of told from a child's perspective. So like the line between fact and fiction is blurred by the author, by the narrator. So Peter Pan is this legendary person who, like legend has it, appears only to kids.
Yeah.
And basically takes them up here and only in their dreams, I think is the other thing too. And
Wendy starts talking to her mother about what Peter. And then
about Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm. And then the mother gets a little bit worried. And then that night when the parents go off to a party, Peter Pan shows up to the kids, teaches them to fly, and then they fly to Neverland that night. And then Nana goes, the dog goes to warn them and the parents come home and they cry out as they find out that their kids are gone. And then the kids go and they basically are visiting on the way to Neverland all these things that they saw in their dreams that they've seen. This is in the book at least. I don't remember, like in the movie, I think that it's a beautiful, they go to the second star on the right, you know, follow through to a morning. And then, but in the book, there's actually more description of the places that they kind of see along the way. And time is really weird. Right. Like it seems like it's weeks, but we don't know how long. It could just be minutes in real lifetime. Right. And then they get to Neverland and, you remember what happens there when they get to Neverland, like what Tinkerbell does to Wendy.
Yeah. She tries to kill her or tries to manipulate the lost boys into killing Wendy by telling them that Wendy is the bad guy or that Wendy is a creature flying at them or something like that.
And they like shoot her with an arrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason the dog couldn't chase away Peter Pan was that their father like punished the dog by taking her to the doghouse
in the kennel.
And then he always blames himself that the kids disappeared. So I think basically it's supposed to be all within like the dream of the kids or something like that. And part of the dream is that the parents are lamenting that their kids are gone. And if only we had been better to them and not put the dog in the kennel that day or whatever, things would be good. But the mother actually sees Peter Pan early in the book. He like appears and like he shows her some teeth, literally. What do you call it? Like
baring your teeth.
What do you call that? There's a better literary.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what you'd call it.
Oh, but, yeah. So
there's something he does. So right from the start, like the mother like knows who Peter Pan is, remembers. She tells her kids stories of when she had spent time with Peter Pan growing up, and now she occasionally sees Peter Pan. And that's kind of a theme that comes up in the book and in the legend, you know, in the various adaptations of Peter Pan, is that adults occasionally get to sort of get another glimpse of Peter Pan, like when their inner child is sort of ready for it, like there and susceptible. So that's kind of an ongoing theme in Peter Pan, that the adults are not completely shut off from any contact with Peter Pan, but he sort of represents childhood bliss and innocence.
Yeah. Yeah. So, when they get to Neverland, they get shot, or Wendy gets shot. She goes down, she reads to them Cinderella. Right. And then she, what's the next thing that happens? So I think they go to the lagoon at that point. Right. So the next plot point is they go to the Mermaid Lagoon. Is that correct? Trying to remember.
I don't remember specifically all the details.
I'm trying to like have general summary of the plot. So like they go to the lagoon. And I'm forgetting exactly what happens at that point plot wise, but at some point, like she becomes their mother, their surrogate mother. She starts to cook and clean. It's all imaginary stuff for them, for the lost boys, of course. And, you know, we hear about all the fantastical creatures in Neverland. And, you know, including about Hook, we learn about Hook a little bit. And then there's a moment when she, trying to remember the next major thing. So I guess the next big thing would be she wants to go home at some point. No. So when they're on the lagoon,
hold on. Why, Little India. Can I get a word in here? Why don't you let me tell some of this story?
We'll tell the summary.
I think you're sort of jumping around a bit. All right. So first off, she becomes their mother right when they realize she's not, you know, that Tinkerbell had lied to them. She sort of adopts them all, including her brothers. And then they start living domestically in their underground house. Mm-hmm. At some point early in the sequence after that, they end up going to the lagoon. Maybe they're swimming or something, but they end up in danger or something like that.
No, it's the Peter Indian, Pan the little girl, the India girl, right?
Pocahontas?
No.
Or, Tiger Lily.
Tiger Lily. Thank you. That's what I was searching for. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
So a lot of these details are sort of blurry, but to me, these are like sort of the forgettable parts in a way. It's like, they're just, to me, it's just the fact that you have Indians, pirates, mermaids, and all these, and animals all on the same island. I take it sort of like kind of lampooning fairy tales and like, or like more like adventure stories, you know? So like, yeah. Before the turn of the century, you had all these big novels about pirates and about Indians and about mermaids and all these things. Mm-hmm. And here's an island where like it's all just happening simultaneously. And again, the line between reality and fantasy is just blurred, and the author is changing things as he goes to just kind of like it's almost like a dream where you can control what happens. Now Peter Pan ends up alone on a lagoon where he's likely to drown, and he famously says, To die would be a great adventure.
Yeah.
That's like that's a very memorable line. And I think he ends up getting saved by the
like a bird. A bird nest.
By the bird, yeah.
Yeah, that's so there's a bird nest that sends him, and he like wraps onto it, and cuz he gave, but he also gave his way out, which I think was like a balloon or an umbrella or something, to Wendy so Wendy could float off and say, but it was only light enough for her or something like that. And so he kind of sacrifices himself for her to save her. And then he's rescued at the end. But then Wendy tells the story of the darlings to the lost boys. And as they're going to leave, they're kidnapped by Captain Hook and the pirates. And then Peter goes on the ship. He starts imitating the sound of the ticking clock from the inside of the crocodile, which of course ate Hook's hand. There's a battle. Hook loses. He gets eaten by the crocodile. On the pirate ship, they go home, and they return again to the darlings. So that, I think that's the basic plot. As far as there might be some little elements, but I think the major events, that's the plot element of it, of the general story that you get told over and over again, and that's in the play and in the book. And there could be different variations on that, obviously. For me, I think the plot is important to kind of hold as a starting point, as just like these are the actual things that happen. And then we can kind of interpret what we think a lot of the characterization, the style, what all of that means. So like, I like what you said a lot about it's told from the perspective of it's, it feels like a child telling the story almost. And it kind of, how did you put it? Like, it plays with fantasy elements, right? And it's obviously very fantastical when they go in the Neverland, but even in the Darling Home, the anthropomorphic Nana, the dog, the way it's written is very interesting because it's not always clear that Nana is even a dog until later. Like, he doesn't actually say that. So it's different. Like, from a play, obviously you would see that instantly, but in literature, this is one of the things that's interesting about literature. If you just read this and didn't know the story about the dog, you would think it was a Nana. And then there'd be like little hints about the way it panted. And you're like, what? And it's like, cause it's not describing a shaggy dog. And then eventually it does describe a shaggy dog. And then you're like, oh, this is a dog. And there's, cause like it seems to have a lot of autonomy and thoughtfulness as a dog. And it puts them to bed at the end of the story. When they try to fly away, it tries to tie a knot to their feet. It's like, how does a dog do that? But of course, he's playing with fact and reality, or fact and fantasy, which I like the playfulness of the style of the book.
Yeah. And so, bringing that to the stage was like a whole new world of innovation. When you think about it, like nothing like that had ever been done on a stage before, to have a dog that could do human type stuff and to have flying on the stage and all these things. By the way, the internet's been lagging a little bit. I hope it's recording it in high quality at your end, but as you talk, it's like lagging pretty badly. I don't know I don't know if it's your internet or what.
I don't know. I'm not getting it on my end at all. So I think on the recorder, okay. I think it's fine.
That's good. That's great then. Okay. So yeah, I think that's basically the plot. Like they land on the island, they end up getting kidnapped by the pirates, the kids do, and Peter goes and rescues them. And like I said, I sort of take it as sort of tongue in cheek, the way that like you have all these different types of creatures, mermaids and pirates and Indians and all these things happening on one island. Like it's just kind of blending together all these different fantastic mm-hmm. types of creatures. So it is very dreamy.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's Neverland, right? So let me ask, why did you choose this? What do you like about Peter Pan? And, you know, when I asked you, you chose this one in particular, this novel. Well, and I was just curious why you chose this one.
Well, the list you sent me had a lot of like, you know, Hemingway and all these things that is not like as moving. It's not like, all right, the Old Man and the Sea. Like, can you imagine us talking about that book? Like there's so much to say about that plot. And I mean, and that the depth of the Old Man and the Sea. Anyway, we're not here to bash Hemingway.
Yeah.
Or you're not here to bash
him. Yeah, I'm not here to bash him. I think that is like much better than you're giving it credit for. But
so, no, I hear you. But to answer your question, so over the last year or so, I've been like really kind of looking back to my earliest of influences, looking back, kind of revisiting art that had impacted me as a kid. And in some cases, that art was religious, you know, Old Testament stories that are obviously very moving. But the Old Testament is not as rich, like psychologically, as like Peter Pan. So what I would do in my mind as a kid, like there was a Peter Pan cartoon that was on TV that I used to watch religiously. I would sort of blend this island where people can fly. I would sort of blend it with divine powers, you know, God can just think anything into existence and manipulate anything and is worshipped and all of these things. I sort of blended them all together, you know, and I was being told unironically that God is very real, very literal. Then why not Peter Pan? And why not this island? And, you know, if someone's going to be chosen, you know, Elijah, the prophet, was chosen. He was a civilian. He was just a normal guy. He was chosen to be not only a prophet, but like a divine, timeless prophet. I was told he was still appearing and performing miracles through the centuries and to this day. So if him, then why not me? I thought. And so in my mind, like this could be real, and maybe it is. And maybe me, why not? You know, maybe I'll be Peter Pan. Maybe I'll be a Power Ranger. Maybe like all these different children's franchises ended up, sort of seeping into this world I was creating when I was, you know, six or so. But, Peter Pan is definitely like the big one. And the more time passes, the more I see how important that story was in the sort of development of the world, like the way we look at stories, the way we look at like kids' stories and just the impact that Peter Pan has had on so many generations. To think there was a time before Peter Pan, like there was a time when no one had anything like that. It's Peter Pan is like taking an urban setting, you know, these are like middle class people in industrial England, mm-hmm. and sending them into fantasy land with pirates and Indians and all this crazy stuff. So it was sort of like a sort of modern adaptation of those adventure stories that had been around for a while. So it's just fascinating to kind of look back at that, to realize, again, there was a time when there was no Peter Pan. And that was sort of devised, invented, and distributed. And today, it's like it's an indispensable part of almost everyone's childhood.
Yeah, I mean, like, think about the Toys R Us song. I think there might be some people are too young and don't even remember Toys R Us. But, you know, I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid. Right? Like, that whole idea of not wanting to grow up, of, you know, wanting to stay a child. All children grow up except one. Peter, that's how Peter Pan starts, right? All children grow up except one. And this idea of eternal youth and, staying a child and what it means to stay a child. And I think for me, the literature, this as literature, as, you know, definitely children's literature, which I take to be literature. It's just a different category than, you know, Hamlet or something, but it's serious literature for children is what I would think of this as. And I think adults should read it as well for a variety of reasons. Very good to reflect on this and to kind of remember certain things. And we can maybe, if we have time, get into that. But you know, like, it's interesting to think about, like, you know, what Tinkerbell represents and what Peter Pan represents and why he is. And I think in the book, you see this more than I remember the movies, which I think is the value of the book, is that you get a little bit more of a glimpse as to the fact that it's a choice that Peter Pan makes to stay a child forever rather than he just kind of is. So he's kind of, so he is making, he's consciously making a choice. Like, I didn't really take it this way, but I, when he wants to kiss, or when Kendi wants, Wendy wants to kiss him, and he thinks, he's like, well, I don't know what that is. And she gives him a thimble, right? I didn't realize this, but I think what happened, and that's more clear in the book, I think, and I'd have to go back and watch some of these movies. Maybe it's in the movies as well, is that, she kind of wants to, like, she knows what a kiss is, right? She learns this from, like, she is on the verge of womanhood. That's why she's kind of becoming obsessed with, becoming a mother. She wants to mother, like, that's stressed over and over again in this book. She wants to, she's a mother all the time. She loves being a mother. She loves all that nurturing. She meets Peter Pan. He's crying on the floor because he can't find his shadow, and she sews it onto him, right, to help him. And she wants to give him a kiss. And there's, since, you know, as a kid, we don't really understand that, but I think there is a kind of becoming a woman and finding a man that Peter and Tinker was, avoid. He's so innocent and doesn't understand it that instead Wendy decides to give him a thimble, and then he gives her an acorn, right? Like, that's the kind, or I think he gives her something, and it's an exchange of that, your most valuable thing. But for him, it's an acorn, which, by the way, I think is also representative. If you think about it, like, an acorn can turn into a tree, right? It's kind of like that. That's how I took that. And I found that fascinating. Just the idea of, you know, how subtle the J.M. Barrie is, really brilliant in the way he's very, you know, in these very innocent things, you know, mistaking a kiss is such a thing that as you watch it as a kid, you're not, you're obviously not contemplating on that level. It's just a cutesy little thing, but it's still embedded, I think, in there. Cause I remember the thimble. I don't know if you remember, but when I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, the thimble. I remember the thimble, and like, oh, like how cute it was. And you know, like my parents would like give me a thimble or something. And like, oh, I give you a kiss. Just like they give you a chocolate kiss. You want a kiss? And they give you a chocolate kiss. Right. And that's just a cute little thing. But I think it also in the story represents something very interesting that's telling overall. Right.
That's interesting. I never really thought that much about the whole, the kiss and the thimble and all of that. That's interesting that that's something you sort of thought a lot about. By the way, the internet is getting so bad, like the lagging, it's like I almost can't understand. Oh. If we hung up and reconnected, would you be able to easily connect the two halves, or that's beyond?
Yeah. Your, so I don't know what's. I mean, if we have to, we can. Let me pause this for a sec. I can pause it. Yeah. What were you gonna say?
So, I never really thought that much about that whole kiss, you know, the thimble and all of that. What I found interesting about the story overall is that it sort of draws a split between childhood bliss and adulthood. Like, you necessarily become less happy, less blissful, more duty bound as an adult. That's just the way it is. And mm-hmm. at the end of the book, you know, some of the lost boys end up moving with them into their house. And as they grow up, one becomes a lawyer, one becomes this, one becomes that, and they're all basically miserable. And so Peter Pan, he's blissful and young and also has no memory at all. Mm-hmm. He has no memory. It's almost like it's saying like having a memory and being in touch with reality is basically the downfall of every angelic child's bliss. But I think the author himself contradicts that in creating this story. He is showing that an adult can do his version of flying, if you will. You know, all Peter Pan really can do is fly. And that's his only superpower. If you told me you could either create magnificent art or fly, I'd rather create art. I know a lot of people would answer differently. But like I said, like when you think about it, like what we do as adults with whatever passion we have, that is like our version of a superpower. So it is like the sort of benefit of a story like any fantasy story, and let's say Peter Pan, we can sort of abstract from that, what is the magic? What's our version of magic? And we realize adults do not need to become miserable. Quite the opposite. A good, like a rational and focused adult with a passion, pursuing his passion, is basically living like Peter Pan well into the end of his life. But you don't really get that from the book. The book sort of, and the story sort of says like, yeah, adults sort of forget about Peter Pan, but maybe some of them can remember, it if, you know, if we remind them. I see it more as like the ongoing theme of your life should be, I am Peter Pan, and I've got even better powers than he does.
Yeah. Interesting. So I guess I would add a little bit about how what Peter is missing is because he is missing out on something. So part of it is, yes, you want, like, Wendy does retain a memory of him because he's supposed to come back every year for spring cleaning, but he often forgets. But I think he comes back at certain periods in her life. And I think part of what J.M. Barrie is saying is like, there are, you can reflect on that, you know, like you were saying you were doing by reflecting back on your life in your childhood. And like, what are the stories that motivated me? And kind of like going back to that pool of, you know, your youth and your passion and kind of refreshing yourself. And I think Peter Pan is that aspect. Now on the flip side, I do think there is a problem with being a pure Peter Pan, right? Like if you are just that, where you don't take on, like he doesn't want to be an adult ever. He never wants to grow up. He never wants to do any of the things that you grow up. And so like Pan, which the idea that you can, you know, Peter Pan is in this stasis and in an arrested development of he is this boy. I think part of what that means is that there's a kind of infinite potentiality for him. He could be anything he wants. And that's, you know, that's the kind of nice thing. So he does do that in the story. In the story, he could be a captain. He could be a fighter. He could fly around. He could play with birds. He could talk to mermaids. You know, I think he can kind of do whatever he wants. And that's nice. To Aristotle defined the child as, you know, the being that something like lived only with appetites, like, You know, it's basically pure appetite, pure desire, not really long range thinking. That's the memory part that you talked about. And I thought that's, we need to have an image of that. And that Peter Pan has become, like you said, a symbol in our society for that kind of eternal innocence and youthfulness and pure potentiality and passion. On the flip side, though, you do need to kind of, as you grow up, take on some kind of, identity and really become an individual, that this is what you decide to do, which sometimes mean you do cut off certain potentialities. What do you think about that?
I think, becoming an adult means becoming more like Peter Pan. You realize you have the powers to do things that Peter Pan could have never dreamed of doing. And there's no real trade-off. I mean, but like the book is sort of saying like, yeah, by kind of growing up and accepting reality, you're basically, you got to leave some of that fantasy behind. But really properly understood, those fantasies are speaking to something that is much more magnificent to you than magic, much more magnificent to you than omnipotence. You have something better than omniscience. You have the ability to make this actual world your own. So I don't know. I don't know if we disagree so much, but I mean, what? To the extent that you see there as like being a trade-off, you need to leave some things behind. I mean, I think that's sort of what the book is saying, but I disagree. I think we see a lot of this sort of theme in the culture ever since then. It's only gotten worse. This whole like children are like precious. We need to basically get them to hold on to this childhood, because once they grow up, they're going to be, you know, crappy adults. Like that's the wrong way to look at it. I think the correct way to look at it. And you see this in like, you know, Howard Rourke, he gets younger, the older he gets, right? That's like one of the things you see about him as he ages, he seems to be getting younger. And, you know, at our best, I think we can relate to that. The more we get comfortable in our own skin and the more we exercise our abilities and expand them.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, so What, so here's the other thing of that. So, you know, maybe we're talking differently. Maybe there's some similarities. Is Peter Pan lives in the world of the imagination. So in other words, the not real. So he lives in a not real place. And we could also translate this into the realm of art. Like, this is the realm of art, stories. Like you were saying, mermaids, pirates, fairies, which we know don't exist, right? So he lives in this non-existence world, and he takes them into that world. And remember, Wendy is obsessed with, or not obsessed, but she loves telling them stories, and they love hearing the stories. Again, I think this is, you know, and then Wendy tells Jane, her daughter, stories, and that inspires her to see Peter, and she wants to go to Neverland. So, like, I think they live in this non-existence, the non-real world, whereas Wendy, Michael, and the other brother, and of course the darlings in London, they live in a very real world. And J.M. Barrie stresses this intensely when Mr. Darling at the beginning is complaining constantly about money. Like, he doesn't have enough money for the children. You know, like children cost money, and he's like, I don't know how we're going to make it. And he's like complaining. To some degree, that's the real world of taking on these kinds of challenges. And Peter Pan lives in this fantasy world where there's no food, where food is, you know, like you just dream it and it's right there. And that this kind of fantasy versus reality, I think, is a big part of what's going on. And we can think about, you know, in order to, so I don't disagree with you that to be an adult and to, you know, take on the wonders of creating something in the real world is a great accomplishment and something to be prideful of and joyful, and all the beauty of passion and knowledge and getting pleasure from those things. But I'm just saying, I think in the book, and you, I think you said you might disagree with some of this. My take is that Barrie is kind of separating this boy who's in this world. But he's not saying that it's not valuable, that I think what he's saying, the value is a kind of, the way I take it as someone who loves literature, is a value of returning to the world of literature, of returning to the world of stories. You know, you put it as like returning to your own, you know, when you were talking about your own youth and the stories of your youth. Does that make sense? Like, that's kind of how I think what J.M. Barrie is making it. And I do think there's kind of, sometimes you do give some things up. Like, you have to cut, you can't do everything. You can't be everything. I don't know.
Yes, you can.
Okay, so one of my points that I was trying to make, I think that J.M. Barrie is making, is about the imaginary world versus the real world. And that Peter Pan lives in the imaginary world. He lives in Neverland, right? It's Neverland, right? Tinker Bell is a fairy, which doesn't exist in real life, as we know. And he even forgets her and she dies, and there's other fairies because, again, they're ephemeral. They're not real. He lives in the world that you were talking about earlier, about mermaids, pirates, these adventure stories. He lives in that world of adventure stories. And the Wendy and the brothers, Michael, and I forget the other name of the other brother.
John.
Thank you. Michael and John and the darlings, they live in the real world. There's reality. And Wendy is on the verge of taking on, you know, her own motherhood identity in that real world. Now, I do think there's a sense where she kind of can go as she gets older, and she does, you know, the last chapter is Wendy grew up, right? That's the last chapter of the book. And, mm-hmm. you know, and she kind of feels bad about this. She feels guilty to some degree that she did, you know, maybe give up on some things, or at least give up on that world of the imagination. But Peter and that memory and that story is always with her, and she can return to that imagination. So me, as a literature person, a person who loves art, I took that, and what I love about it is the idea that this is why I love literature and art, is that that's what you'd use that imaginative world for, is to kind of inspire to go back to that, or that's one aspect of it. So that's what I think he's saying. Now, you were trying to say something about adulthood and like how Peter Pan is the best of the adults or something. Can you maybe clarify that a little bit?
Well, so the author shows everyone growing up and becoming basically miserable. And Peter Pan is this glimpse of childhood bliss that they occasionally get to revisit. And especially like, so Wendy becomes a mother and then a grandmother. And she, so she gets to like meet Peter Pan again in sort of vicariously seeing her children meet him, so to speak, or meet him. But I think there's a fundamental error that the author is suggesting. And I think the author himself contradicts that in creating this book, in being a successful innovator in the stage as well as the written word. He is demonstrating in his own life that Peter Pan is forever, that you could be, that pursuing the rational life, sorry to use that language here when we're just here to talk about, you know, fairy tales, but living, you know, living the properly selfish, rational life, it gives you a power and the ability to feel better than any, really, in a sense, better than a child or the adult equivalent of it, I'll say, not better or worse, the adult equivalent. I would offer that when a child fantasizes about magic, it's not that the child wants to defy reality. Maybe that is part of it, but like the it's like the desire, it's the power that I think is can be abstracted. And the older you get, I mean, if a child is in a healthy environment and let's say he likes music and his parents give him an instrument and start letting him learn that, if he likes a certain subject at school and he excels at that, he pursues a certain career as he grows older, he falls in love and all of these things. The person is sort of doing the adult version of Peter Pan. So this conventional wisdom that the climax of your life is childhood, I think it's present in the Peter Pan universe, but I think it's wrong. And I think it's had a negative influence on a lot of the way people look at the world. They also try to preserve their children's preserve their children's childhood by spoiling them, by lying to them, telling them that fantasy is real and all of these things. I mean, we saw this growing up in the 90s, right? Like a lot of households revolve around the children and it's just, I think a healthier view of life is that like there is the adult version of being Peter Pan. All Peter Pan really can do is fly. That's all he can really do. But as an adult who is with a good set of tools in your mind, in your head, like you could fly too and do a lot more than that. I mean, you can do all types of magnificent things. So, again, I don't know if we disagree per se,
no, maybe I don't because think we
the internet was glitchy before. Yeah.
No, I don't think we disagree. I think, obviously I don't disagree with the idea of what the rational mind can do and that there's value in that. Now, maybe correct me if I'm wrong. Here might be the disagreement. Let's see if this is the disagreement. Is that earlier it seemed like you said that you didn't have to give anything up when you, like, there isn't a trade-off. Is that correct in terms of becoming an adult, a man or a woman?
Right.
You don't think there's any trade-offs in life. So, like, you don't think...
I mean, exit, you're not going to be provided for. Well, in the modern world, you can still get provided for, but, I mean, that's a choice you need to make as an adult.
We're all becoming Peter Pans. In a sense, right? We're all becoming...
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, in infantilization. I mean, this takes us over to other cultural issues, and infantilization is a big thing. And I would say, like, the sort of misunderstanding of that childhood bliss that I think we sort of see in I love the author, but I think he sort of brings this misunderstanding with him. This sort of split between childhood bliss versus adult mundaneness, I think is wrong. And I think the author... in his own deed contradicts it with the inspiring actions that he took to create this piece.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the role that literature, like I was saying, I think that's what literature plays, is that he is saying the role of stories and, you know, literature and art is to, you know, live in that world, that it is a kind of a real place. Even if Neverland isn't somewhere that I can get in my car, like my real car, and go to, it is a place that I can actually go to. Like I believe in fairies, and then the fairy exists because I said I believe in fairies, right? Like that whole, and you clap, right? They would do that. I think during the plays, everyone would clap to bring Tinkerbell back to life when she drinks the poison that Hook gave to Peter Pan. And I think you're right that in his story, he is saying, that's the role that stories play. And Peter Pan is essentially a story. And so like there is value in him in that, and there is value in returning to him as, you know, as stories, no matter how old you are. It's a pleasure. It's enjoyable. And I think it can spark, you know, like going back to that fount for yourself. Now I, you know, sticking on the trade-off thing though, that I think is what is the problem with Peter Pan, the tragedy of, if you look at Peter Pan, especially in the book that I think is clearer, what's sad about it is that he doesn't feel love. He will never feel real love with like sexual love, because he doesn't see Wendy as a potential mate, which she did at first, right? When she first sees him and she wants to give him a kiss. And then he sees her kind of as the surrogate mother, but it's a really vague concept. He's kind of the father at some points, but it's not really, you know, he pretends like he's the father and he does, you know, he acts it out a little bit, but not really acting it out. Right. And, but he never gets to kiss. And part of what I mean by the trade-off is like when you fall in love for, let's just take romantic love, barring today's weird, some of today's non-monogamous things, that means you're not loving every other woman potentially out there. So Peter Pan, by not making a decision of loving her, is in a potential love with all women, in a sense, right? It's a potential, right? That's the the immaturity of not, and that's what I mean by trade-off, is that when you pick a career, so you can do more than one career, but when you pick a career, even Howard Rourke could have been an engineer or something, right? He could have been a great inventor like a John Galt, but he decided to be an architect. So that means he doesn't do these other things by its nature. Now he can do some of them, but so it seems like you don't agree with that.
No, because like in the abstract, you can say by making one choice, you are giving up an infinite other amount of choices. But in reality, when you look at the world firsthand, when you want to be an architect, that's what you want to be. It's not about,
I agree,
I want to give up, you know, it's like,
yeah, I agree.
So, you know,
but you can't be a race car driver professionally.
Do you want to be a race car driver?
He might have wanted to. The point is that when you make, so that's the thing with Peter Pan, is Peter Pan can want to do anything, and then he could do that thing in his mind because he doesn't actually do it. That's the whole point, is that's what I'm saying. So you're right. When you make a choice and that's what you love, I agree. Like I love literature. I love doing that. And so that's the path I've chosen, but I'm not doing other paths that I could have chosen. Now, maybe this is the one that I love, fine, but it's still at the expense of other things. In Peter's world, he can do anything and everything is open possibility, but then there's no nothing. There's no it thing. So there's no what you're talking about. There's no career path he's going to choose. Because he could choose anyone. I mean, it's like kids in college. Like I remember when I was in college and I would talk to kids, like, you know, when I first went, I went to college and I dropped out when I was like 18, 19, I was going to business school and I was talking to people like, so, you know, why are you in school? What is this? You know, what are your dreams and aspirations? And you know what most people said? I don't know. like what? You don't know what you like. I think you and I would have this in common. I was just so shocked that nobody had any clue what they wanted, like what they were passionate about. It made no sense to me. So they were all Peter Pans in my view.
Yeah. So, I think you're making my point that they're not, those undecideds are not more blissful than you. They're less blissful. So the point is, I think
I agree.
The sort of fundamental problem with Peter Pan is that like, you get the impression that like being a child means having no responsibility or like childhood bliss. It needs to be traded away and you rarely see it again. The more you adapt to reality and learn how to live in it and to pursue realistic goals.
Yeah.
But the truth is you get more blissful the more you do that. The more you differentiate fantasy from reality and actually attain real life values, the more you become a real life Peter Pan. And you see that in like successful people that are also giddy about it. Like they don't have guilt about it. You know, Robin Williams was a wonderful, actor to cast as like the adult Peter Pan. He once he rediscovers that side of him, it's just a joy to watch.
Yep. I agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we are on the same page with that. Yeah. I think, you know, that's, the thing that I loved about the book, having just read it for the first time, mm-hmm. because you told me to, and I appreciate that. And the thing that I loved about it was just that it was the interplay between the two. So if you take it as like a literature, you know, work of art, what I saw was you have this interplay between Wendy becomes an adult. I don't know that she's not happy with her life. Like you could say that about other characters, maybe, although the darlings end up that they really love their kids, right? So they were complaining about stuff, but they really do love their kids. The father is kind of in the kennel because he feels so sad, right? He actually sleeps in the kennel because he feels so sad about what he did. Although there is a moment when the wife, Mrs. Darling, says to him, because everybody is giving him sympathy, right, in the community. She's like, are you sure you don't like this? And he's like, no, how could you say that, right? Like, are you sure you don't like the kind of sympathy of having lost your kids? But so I think, like, my take is that the parents start off as kind of tyrants. They lock Nana away, you know, and then they go do what they want to do, which is go have fun at the party. And then that's when they lose their kids. Hook is the other adult who is, remember, in the book, he is, and I think this might be in the, I don't know if this is in the 53 Disney version, but I think it might be in some of them, where he is this school, like he's basically, I remember he's focused on form, having good form from like his upbringing as, you know, in school, right? In school, and that's one of the things he hates about Peter Pan is Peter Pan seems to effortlessly have good form, right? He never does the wrong thing and he's just always doing the right thing. And that infuriates Hook. But I think like Hook is the other adult and he's this evil tyrant who like wants to kill Tiger Lily and people like that, which is one of the reasons I think that Peter Pan doesn't want to be an adult. Cause like to him, that's what it means to be an adult. And he was abandoned by his mother. Remember, his mother locked the door or closed the window when he left. And when the Wendy and all of them come home, finally, when they do fly home, Peter Pan locks that window at first because he wants it. And then he kind of debates that, is he going to do this? And then he eventually, because he feels bad for the mother and says, this mother isn't like my mother. This mother loved her children. So he lets them come back home basically. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that there's a interplay that's interesting about, you know, adulthood and what you gain from adulthood and, you know, that regular returning to the land of Peter Pan. And I like the interplay. I thought it was interesting.
I mean, to me, like Captain Hook was like the most interesting thing in the whole book. That's probably why I wanted to discuss this book further. Like Captain Hook, his whole like preoccupation with good form versus bad form.
Yeah.
Like this is, I was like, what is he supposed to represent? Like a maladjusted adult or like a rebellious teenager. Maybe he's like more like a teenager, not so much a grown up yet. Like he's more like an adolescent who he was like told in school, have good form. And now he's both rebellious, but at the same time, he wants to be the best version of himself. It was just, I love when him and Peter Pan face off and he tricks Peter Pan into having bad form. He kind of signals to Peter, like, use your foot to kick me instead of stabbing me. And Pan does it. He kicks him off the boat and Hook jeeringly cries, bad form. Or he falls to his death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And, yeah.
It's like so interesting to me. Like, I don't really know what the author is exactly saying with Captain Hook and the whole good form, bad form, but it's psychologically rich. And I mean, the whole book feels like a dream. So maybe the author is sort of grabbing these different elements of reality and sort of blending them in ways that the author doesn't necessarily know what exactly he's aiming to say about life. It's just, he's sort of grabbing these various elements, such as, you know, being someone like Captain Hook and what he contends with and sort of presenting it as sort of part of this dream, right?
Yeah, I mean, that could be, it's hard. It's always hard to psychoanalyze a author after the fact. How much did they know? How conscious was it? Was he just taking fairy tale? Like, because I think there is a generic fairy tale model that he's kind of following to some degree, or maybe even flipping on its head. And he probably was very familiar with fairy tales. I don't know much about his biography. So my point is, I don't know. You know, maybe somebody could study his life intensely and get into his head a little bit to figure out how much he consciously knew. I mean, it would be interesting because I agree with you. Hook was so sympathetic. I mean, there's a kind of sympathetic element where when I read this book, that's not in the movies as much often, where he's just kind of this comical evil figure where, you know, he's basically been maybe betrayed in his youth or something. And he's trying to be this thing. And he's, you know, being pursued by this crocodile that has a clock in it, which is, to me, that's like death, right? Like that's the mortality that pursues us all in a sense. Mm-hmm. And Hook has that and he's being pursued by it all the time. And it's horrifying for him, of course. And it really petrifies him. And I think that petrification that, you know, he gets frozen almost, and the other men on the ship jeer at him when he does that. Like they start turning on him. And I think part of that is the, you know, just the eternal worry about death. And then the thing you can do about it is become a tyrant. And that's what he does. He's very tyrannical to the men when he's trying to be like, he seems like he might be nice at some points. And then there's a moment when he's like, no, I got to, you know, these guys aren't going to listen. So I got to be tough with them. And he like smacks them around or something. And that's what he has to do. He has to be tough with them. And, you know, and then the good form thing, I took that as, this is because the lost boys that come back, remember there's a moment when they like lament that they came back because now they have their school uniforms, they have their books, they're studying things and they have to do the things that you're supposed to do in good society, just like Hook does, right? To be a good society, which a pirate is the opposite of good society, right? A pirate abandons good society. And, but Hook still like has that attachment to good form, wanting to have good form, but he can't have it because now he's a pirate. Now he's on the opposite side of that. And the fact that he wants it, like there's this inner monologue when he's like, I want this. Ah, that's bad form. To want it is bad form. And so he's like stuck in this world where he has bad form by his very nature, but he still wants that, you know, London high society type thing.
And yeah, it's really, yeah, it's like kind of neurotic. He's like, yeah. He wants good form, and then he realizes wanting it means you don't have it, and it's
which is inferior.
Beating himself up. Yeah,
which is true. I think like to a lot of people who try to live by society standards, there is a kind of like doing it in itself is kind of a negative, like it's destructive to you. And there might be some of that in there.
And like he sort of maybe represents like a rebellious young person or a little bit older, like entering adulthood and the ticking clock, you know, the ticking of the clock that the alligator swallowed is sort of like, you know, time, the clock is ticking, old age is coming or adulthood. And then of course death and it haunts him. And, he's, as much as he wants to be rebellious, he can't quite, he's not omniscient. He can't just decide this is the person I am. He needs to exercise to be that person. He needs to have good form. If he wants it, he needs to act like it. He can't be sloppy. So, I mean, it speaks to the experience of adolescence and young adulthood, like this sort of catch 22 where like on one hand I could, yeah, that's right. I can do whatever I want. You know, I'm independent, but at the same time being effective and, being successful means, you know, standing up straight and, you know,
being tough,
good form,
showing his toughness to the other men. Right. Yeah. Like I agree 100%. Like there's like a cost to being the adult leader in that sense, that he can't just enjoy his life. Like he's got to do, and that's the alternative to Peter Pan. That's the opposite to Pan is this adult who's chosen that particular path as Hook. And Hook seems to be stuck in that world because he's made the choice to be a pirate. That's why I took that, is that he's a pirate. He's always a pirate. He's always going to be a pirate. And that's all that there is to it. And so he has to do that, even if he wants to do good form or be nice. And again, like the men almost turn on him in two cases, at least that I remember, that you know, when he wants to, when the crocodile's there and they see that he's like that and they're like, what's wrong with you? Like, and they start yelling at him a little bit and then he's got to like buck up and he comes up with the plan of sending, like there's a ticking in this dark room and he wants to, and so he's too terrified. And so the men start turning on him, the other men on the ship. And so he comes up with the idea to send the kids in. Right now we know that the ticking is Peter Pan. So he sends the kids in to go find out what it is and either kill the thing or be killed themselves. And the men cheer it. So the point is that like I saw that as like, he's kind of trapped in that world where he has to make those decisions because he decided to be a pirate. And that is the opposite of what Peter Pan is. Where, again, this is my theory of the interpretation, that Peter Pan is the kind of opposite where he has an infinite potentialities in that. But yeah.
Yeah. Again, I see Captain Hook as sort of like an attempt at being powerful as an adult or as a mm-hmm. young adult, like, or even an old adult, like attempting to play God and like be in charge and stuff, but still sort of being neurotic and trying to assert yourself over other people and stuff like that, like kind of contending with the facts. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Peter Pan, so he has no memory, like he forgets stuff right away, and he has like no, he doesn't care what's true and what's not. He just decides, everything's arbitrary with him. So Peter Pan can just say, we all ate dinner tonight, and then there's just no dinner that night. Or he can say, we haven't eaten, let's eat, and then they get to eat. So
yeah,
there's a lot of stuff happening in this book, huh?
Yeah, I think there's a ton. That's what's interesting about it, is it's well done. It's a good, full, you know, fleshed out fairy tale about this boy that, you know, never grows up and the people in his life and the people that remember him, because they remember him, but he doesn't really remember them. Like, he doesn't even remember Tinkerbell, right? He forgets Tinkerbell at the end when Wendy asks about him. He said, oh, fairies don't live very long, right? So she might have been mm-hmm. somebody I knew back then or something. And, you know, there's an interesting aspect of that. I think about his, you're saying, with the memory.
Yeah. Tinkerbell is, she saves his life at one point. Like she drinks the poison before he could or something like that. Yeah. And she's in love with him and she's vindictive and spiteful. She hates Wendy through the whole story. Yeah. And you know, if you believe in fairies, they exist. But if you say, there's no such thing, then one of them dies. That's one of the things in Peter Pan. And it's, yeah, sort of encouraging people, like, don't stop believing in fairies. And again, I would say you can abstract something from that is not saying be, you know, indulge in falsehoods, but rather believe in kind of the your version of fairies that is very much tied to reality. So, you know, real life fairies are not vindictive. Real life fairies are, you know, paths, courses of action, you know, rules to live by that can get you very far. So again, I see a split that the author creates, like between childhood bliss versus the harsh constraints of reality. And perhaps Tinkerbell is the sort of epitome of that, where she's so vicious, yet she is that spark of magic that children need to believe in to retain that bliss.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what do you think of Tinkerbell as a, she's seems to be the conduit to this Neverland, right? She's the fairy dust that goes on them, right? And, you know, what do you think of her as like a protector of keeping Peter Pan in that world? Like that, I don't know if you agree, but that's kind of what I saw her as when she was trying to stop the thimble, stop the kiss. She wants to get rid of Wendy because she realizes Wendy, if he kisses Wendy, right, then he will start to learn what, this is what you were saying. And this, I agree with you completely. Like, if he kisses Wendy, then he learns what it means to have a passion, right? He learns what it means to have a singular passion. And then he'll want that. And he'll want to give up that. That's, I think that it's been a long time since I've seen Hook. But I think that's part of what the message at the end of Hook is that he loves his kids, right? And so that's worth, you know, it's worth going back to his kids and giving up the Peter Pan powers that he has to get in order to fight Hook off again, right? If I remember that correctly, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie. And
I want to talk about Hook for sure, but first about just Tinkerbell. Yeah, so she's like, she's the one that enables people to fly by sprinkling the pixie dust on them. And, yeah, like I said, she kind of, Tinkerbell represents that, you know, magic and supernatural abilities that only kids that believe are able to do. Yeah, and she's jealous. I took that at, you know, jealousy at Wendy.
Yeah.
So
I think her individual characterization is she's jealous of Wendy. I guess the question is why. And for me, I took that as she's jealous because, you know, she wants Peter to herself in her Neverland. If Wendy kisses her, she will lose Peter. For sure. Peter will become a man. He'll become Robin Williams. And that's you know, as an adult. And that's what happens in Hook. I think.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that what happens?
Well, like let's talk about it. We can talk about Hook. I think we talked about the book plenty.
Yeah. Remind me a little bit because I loved that a long time ago, but it's been several years since I've seen it. So, yeah. Am I getting it right that he kind of, he does grow up?
Obviously. Yeah. So in Hook, which I watched recently after finishing the book, Hook is much more interesting than the Disney movie, by the way. The Disney movie is like, I think they were just, those early Disney movies, they were basically just showing what they can do visually. That was exciting to them, and rightfully so. Yeah. They were doing their version of what I described, you know, not letting the given have the final word, but pushing it, asserting yourself and creating new stuff. But the plot of the Disney movie has, you know, very, very little to do with the book, right? It's not nearly as rich. Now in Hook, Robin Williams is Peter Pan all grown up, which you find out later in the movie. It's not obvious right away. So he is a lawyer who just is never paying attention to his wife and kids, right? He's always on the phone. What do you mean? The poor person wants to collect money for his injury. You know, just like one of these Hollywood depictions of the vicious, cruel, cutthroat. Everyone's looking away to screw the union and the little guy at every possible turn. So he's not paying attention. So that is, again, you see this split, like a guy who loves his career needs to trade his family for it. Basically is kind of what you see from the start.
Does he love his career or does he just have a career?
Good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a kid's movie. You don't get to really know what law means to him. But I mean, like, so they go and visit Wendy, and Wendy is the woman who raised him. So all he remembers is he was at one point an orphan, and this older woman, Wendy, adopted him, and as well as other orphans, the lost boys, if you will. But she ends up raising Peter, and now. And ends up actually marrying Wendy's actual granddaughter. So Peter Pan. So basically, Peter Pan would revisit that house every so often. And first, it was Wendy who he met with. Then later on, it was Wendy's daughter who he ended up meeting. And finally, in the 1960s, he flies through the window, and Grandma Wendy is putting her granddaughter.
Maybe
to
this
bed,
Peter's got a good plan, man. I don't know. You know.
And baby, whatever the girl's name is, maybe it's Wendy too, I don't know, but she's got like the Beatles on her pillowcase and like it's the 60s. Now, this movie was made in the 90s, so the 60s was not that long before, right? It was 25, 30 years, maybe more like 20 years earlier, like late 60s going into early 90s. And then this time he decides he wants to stay. Like he likes Wendy's granddaughter, ends up kissing her while she's asleep, which, you know, please, nobody watching this, take this as instructive. I mean, this is absolutely,
don't do that.
Hashtag stuff 90s movies got away with. Let's just leave it at that. But, you know, Wendy ends up raising raising Peter along with her own granddaughter, and Peter ends up marrying, Wendy's granddaughter, because they're the same age, and now they're going back with their own kids to go back to London from America to London. They visit Wendy, and Wendy has one of the lost boys like living in her home. I forget which one it was, but one of the guys with the silly name, is like a crazy guy, crazy old man, like crawling around and acting crazy. The things he's seen, he believes it's all real, and he's a crazy guy. So anyway, you know, they go, they say hi to Wendy. He's still on his phone every minute, yelling at his partner. No, I said, don't do this. No, don't do that. And Wendy asks him something like, oh, so what do you do for a living? Goes, I'm a lawyer. And she says something like, oh, so you've become like a pirate, basically, something like that. Like you've become a pirate, right? That's what she says. And it's like, yeah, like the movie definitely has an agenda in that respect, which I see as a logical outcome of some of what this book contains. This sort of split between being rational and an adult versus being an innocent, blissful child. So in reality, being a lawyer is a very, not only a respectable career, but a requirement. It's, I mean, law is a serious issue like that matters for people to live in a civilized manner. And there's no shame in being a lawyer. Obviously depends what you do as a lawyer, I suppose. But so she tells him, oh, so you became a, pirate, basically, is what she tells lawyer Peter. So he's kind of embarrassed. But anyway, he ends up his kids get kidnapped by Captain Hook, one of those nights. And then Tinkerbell shows up, Julia Roberts, a very poorly adapted character. I mean, of all the characters that they adapted, you know, Peter Pan, Captain Hook, Smee, they did a good job, but Tinkerbell is nothing like she was originally. She's not spiteful, she's not petty at all. She is basically an adult.
Yeah.
Adult Julia Roberts, who's here to, you know, show Peter Pan
that you can put in your pocket.
She's just a small version of an adult with wings. And so she takes Peter to Neverland, where he sees his kids are kidnapped by Captain Hook, and that he agrees with Hook, if I fight you, if I kill you, if I fight you and I win, I get my kids back. So then he goes to train with the Lost Boys and with Tinkerbell. And the Lost Boys are it's a 90s movie. The Lost Boys are very punk rock. They're into skateboarding and right. vulgarity, you know, Rufio. Rufio is yelling at Peter Pan and he's calling him all these names. I mean, that was not in the book originally. The Lost Boys were very sweet and like and innocent and you know and wondrous about the world in the book. In the 90s movie, the Lost Boys are punks. And but nonetheless, Peter Pan kind of rediscovers his youth and becomes Peter Pan again and then flies back to the ship. And meanwhile, Hook had sort of gotten the kids to believe that he's a better father to them because he'll let them smash the clocks. He'll let them smash the clocks and stay youthful. And, you know, Peter fights Hook and they're sort of a nice, I mean, there's a good like lesson sort of at the end, there's a good conclusion, which is like, yes, we're going back to reality. Dad is still going to be a lawyer. Although I think when they get back, he quits his job or something. Maybe he throws his phone away or he says, you know, go F yourself. I'm keeping it clean here. I don't remember what exactly Peter Pan does.
I remember the phone back in the snow or something at the end. Like
that's early on. Oh, yeah, okay. That's at the end. Well, early on, his wife throws his phone out the window.
Okay.
But then at the end, yeah, he digs up his phone and he says something really stupid and irresponsible to his work partner whose life is invested. Children somewhere are not going to eat that night. You know, like people's lives are going to be hurt. Maybe a defendant in court will end up going to prison because his lawyers were not able to defend him properly. Whatever it was, this lawyer says, hey, I don't want to do anything, you know, throws his phone back into the snow and runs around with his kids like an idiot. So at the end of the day, this theme that I take issue with, there's split between adulthood and childhood bliss is, you know, it's present throughout. But the movie is still very sweet in a number of aspects in that, you know, they do end up coming back to the real world and the kids sort of realize their father does love them, even if he had been very busy with his job and all that. But I love how Captain Hook in Hook, he talks about good form and bad form. And at one point Hook cheats like early in the movie. He shoots at Peter or something. He shoots somebody in a way where it's an unfair advantage. And the child yells, bad form.
Yeah.
I love how the movie is. Hook is all about the book. You see the book, they talk about the book. And another thing that's in this movie is that Wendy says that J.M. Barrie actually lived next door to them growing up and he kind of came up with these stories with them or told them it. And that's kind of part of it as well. Mm. So, and then the lost boy, the crazy old man that lives with Wendy at the end of the movie, you might remember this. He ends up getting picked up by Tinkerbell. And
he lost his marbles. Didn't he?
He lost his marbles.
That's what it was. I remember that. He lost his
marbles. Going back to Neverland, like Tinkerbell or whoever grabs him and takes him back to Never Neverland. So, look, this ongoing split between pursuing a career versus being a blissful person or a childlike blissful person, I think is it's prevalent.
Family versus career.
Yeah, that's part of it. You know, your kids versus career basically is what it amounts to. Your kids versus your career. I mean, it is true. You do need to allot your time properly. But I mean, the movie grossly overemphasizes that, I think. And it speaks to this idea that was in the book. And I think it got worse with every generation. Each generation was spoiled worse than the one before and told how perfect they are. And, you know, the self-esteem movement and all of that. Each generation's gotten worse than before. And today we're at a point where the children are telling the adults what's okay and what's not, right? They're policing our language now. You got little kids telling us, how dare you? And do not use that pronoun. I mean, Jesus Christ, what's the world come to?
Greta Thunberg is like wagging her thumb, her finger at a group and a whole world of people who make her whole existence possible. Right.
Of course.
Right? Yeah. It's like, how dare you? It's like, the hell are you, 15-year-old kid, telling the world what to do?
Yeah. And like you said, well, yes. And also she was raised a certain way and the adults around her have certain premises. And so, a good thing to do would be a better thing would have been if that energy had been harvested in a way to be dedicated towards a rational pursuit. So Greta could have been a wonderful something or another. She could have been very successful with that level of energy, but she's dedicated, of course, to the destruction of life of humans on Earth.
Yeah, yeah, basically. Right? Mm-hmm. Well, so what the reason I brought that up is, you know, you were just the idea of the reverence for children, which I think is a Rousseauian concept. I think this goes back to Rousseau in particular. And I was going to bring this up earlier, but, you know, in his most famous book, Emile, where he talks about on education and about how childhood is a kind of its own sacred time that we should basically preserve and kind of nurture and allow to do what it wants to do, rather than the kind of classicism of, you know, like you're saying about putting on manners. Like, so he was all about let kids be wild, just like the noble savage, right? Children are a kind of noble savage. Let them be wild. Let them get dirty. Don't worry about teaching them about, you know, math and science and, you know, and literature. Don't worry about that. Don't teach them Latin. Just let them play and have fun and things like that. And, you know, when you're talking about, like, we have this reverence for kids in that sense, in a certain way, I think that's part of it. I think Peter Pan is part of that tradition, perhaps. And I agree that there's a problem with that, you know, not just children as an age issue, but also just kind of like, you know, you have these like 25, 30-year-old and older, you know, men and women who are like these woke scold type people who like are doing the same thing, but they happen to be 30. Right. And so it's like they're doing the same thing where they're wagging fingers and they're telling people, but they're immature and they don't have any clue how to actually make, you know, fixes. Right. They want to fix the world, but they don't even know how to do that. Or even they just say, just do it. Right. Just somehow. I mean, even like I remember Obama in 2008, I think it was, when the Deepwater Horizon exploded. And I just remember the look on his face when he screamed, plug that damn hole. It's like, it's not that easy, man. Like, this is hard engineering science. Your passion and excitement isn't going to actually do all the science that's necessary, right? So I agree that that's a big, you know, a big problem is the kind of infantilization of the West. And the
premise is the noble savage is the standard, right? That's pure good.
That's pure good.
The child is like basically like a savage. He hasn't been corrupted by society yet.
And we get, and, yep.
And that's kind of, it's there. So anytime you're confused, how has the world gotten so ridiculous? You could sort of, you might be reminded of these premises, and it makes a little bit more sense. So, yeah, I mean, and with Rousseau and with any philosopher, take the worst philosophy on earth, you could still find a kernel of truth in it. I mean, take anything. I mean, can you think of, like, what do you think is the worst possible philosophy? Let's say, like, egalitarianism applied to the environment, like
environmentalism.
Let's say that, like, okay. Where, like, the standard feminism. Is feminism. Okay, let's say that. I mean, the kernel of truth there obviously is that women are not slaves. But the kernel of truth with environmentalism is nature, you know, quote, nature is beautiful. Trees are wonderful. A clean air is wonderful. I mean, there's a kernel of truth in there's consequences to your actions. So if you pollute today, you're going to have to deal with that tomorrow. I mean, there's plenty of truth in a lot of bad philosophy. So with Rousseau, I guess when he's saying innocent, like the innocence of a child, there's something there that should not be forgotten. Or if he's saying the noble savage, you know, yes, sure, savages are like a lot of them could walk lightly and they could, their sense of hearing is very strong because they're not complacent living in an apartment with ventilation and all that stuff, right? Like
they're more tuned to nature.
Yeah, so to speak, nature, quote unquote. There are
two. Well, I mean, to the forest.
Yeah, they have certain skills and they have a certain attachment to reality that that are worth preserving and learning and training at and getting good at. I mean, there's all types of good lessons you can learn from bad philosophies, but you do need to like identify what's wrong with this philosophy and what's a better alternative.
I agree. Yeah.
So, like, I see a lot of the Peter Pan as like sort of an attempt to say something very benevolent and very good, but the sort of what I see as the negative part of Peter Pan, like this dichotomy between being an adult versus being blissful and having superpowers, is it's gotten worse over time, and people take it literally. I mean, think of like Michael Jackson and his sleepover parties and all that. It's like, we need to properly integrate. I know that there's a can of worms I just opened. Yeah.
That's a whole nother thing.
I've actually heard the case made that Michael Jackson's slumber parties were highly exaggerated. That is, the families of the children pressured him into it in cases that were later used to make allegations against him. So I just want to mention that, since we're trying to.
Well, I never saw those documentaries, so I know everyone took that as like evidence. I don't know. Maybe they were evidence.
Well, the worst thing about
bad things, but I don't know.
What bothered me when looking up Peter Pan and Neverland, I see this HBO documentary, Leaving Neverland. Like the fact that this propaganda piece is mentioned, that it comes up in your search results when you're looking up stuff related to Peter Pan is unfortunate. But you know, what can you do? But so the article I'm talking about was in the Objective Standard, you know, that look for the issue with an illustrated Michael Jackson on the cover. And the author of that article strongly states that the allegations against Peter Pan are largely based on, against Michael Jackson, excuse me, are largely based on sort of falsified or exaggerated circumstances. So check that out. Anyway.
Well, that sounds interesting. No, because I wasn't certain about that. And it seems like I think there's a lot of confusion about that. Like if you think about today versus the past, where if you even as a male, especially a single male, pretend to like, a kid, you're automatically this horrible pedophile, right? And there's this weird dichotomy that we have today where it's like, I just, like if you think about the 50s where you could like just, talk to any kid and just, pat them on the head and say, have a good day or whatever, you could even play with someone else's kids. Like today you can't do that without being this horrible person assumed right away. And I think there's a weird thing where it's like, everybody's assuming just because you say that you like kids or whatever, that's a weird feeling to have. And so you have to be a pedophile. Now, I don't know. Again, I don't know this case. Maybe he was a pedophile, which is a problem, obviously, and should be punished very severely. But there's also the case where I think sometimes because, you know, like the Michael Jackson must have had some kind of real psychological infantilization of his own consciousness where he did want to live in this permanent state of being a child, maybe too much. I don't know, that might have been a problem. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, to the extent he was not attuned with reality and not living by a rational philosophy, his quest for childhood would probably resulted in all types of problems, which is why he got more messed up as time passed and got to a point where he was getting injected with one thing in the morning and injected with something else to help him sleep and ended up dying at age 50 or 51.
Yeah,
but I mean, but the fact in of itself that he used his fortune to build Neverland Ranch to have all these you know fun stuff and all that, I see no problem with that. As you can see, I've got an arcade cabinet behind me and various other things in the
room. That's what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like if you love kids, you want kids around you, that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. But I think it sometimes is taken that way today. So it's like we have to protect kids, we have to revere them. They're fragile. They can't handle anything. That's one aspect of kids. And then the other one that I find really interesting about our approach to children today, in education in particular, in the education system, is there's a story about St. Peter about his daughter Petronilla. And I don't know if you've ever heard this story, but it's basically Petronilla is his daughter. She is, through the powers of St. Peter, he keeps her basically close to deathly asleep all the time in order to preserve her from the horrors and the corruption of the world, right? From all the things that can happen in the real world. And preserving her virtue in that way. And that's one way to think about education, is that you can preserve a kid completely from any of the problems of the world. In our education system, we actually do the very opposite, where in geography class, they're worried about the problem of famine in the third. Like, that's what they're learning in geography class, right? They're learning about nuclear power plants exploding, and they're learning about global warming is going to kill us all. And they're worrying, you know, think about a 9-year-old worrying about the problem of abortion in certain places, right? Or not having abortion and women's rights. And it's like, they're 9, 10, like these are kids. So it's like you have Petronilla on the one angle, completely preserved. You lock her in a tower and you don't let her or him experience the world at all. And then the reverse of that is what I think of as the Greta Thunbergs, where they're worried and burdened with the worries of the world as the opposite of that. And I don't know, like, it's just such a weird, and maybe some of this comes because we can't, we think of kids as like this special entity that can't be corrupted or I don't know, like, you know, that we look at it as so not, they're not human in a sense. Like if you look at old paintings, like a couple hundred years ago, what's really interesting is most of the kids, like especially the boys, now girls were a little bit different, but we could talk about that. But the boys would be dressed as little men. They look like if it was a hunting picture of a family, the boy would have like a rifle and he would look like a little man, even if he was like 6, 7 years old. Right. Versus now it's like they're little cherub fairies is how we kind of think of them. And that I think is a Rousseauian, William Blake, a lot of the romantic poets made that kind of distinction that goes into Peter Pan and continues to today. And so we have like this weird view of kids today.
Well, you know, the more from what I know about progressive education in its early sort of stated mission, they said both of what you described. Let kids be unsupervised, basically. Let them express themselves and do whatever they want. But also the purpose of education is to socialize them. So we're not here to teach them how to think. We're here to basically tell them what to do and how to live and what to think. So I mean, we see both. We see, so you're just saying on one hand, we're seeing this, on the other hand, we're seeing that. I think it's maybe all part of the one same effort to not give kids the tools that they need and then having them ready to mold and manipulate into being good little well-socialized soldiers for the Nile. The Nile? Is that what you would call it? The Nil?
What do you mean the Nile?
The nil, like this, the zero, the Nile.
Oh, the nil. Yeah, nil.
The nil, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Soldiers of the Nil. And there's a good name for a band if any musicians are watching that. The name of a song, rather.
Soldiers of the Nil.
Maybe a band too. Soldiers of the Nil. That's a good.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I like
a lot of good band names.
A lot of good. There's always a lot of good bands. Yeah.
Always good band name. So, do you want to talk about, or go ahead, did I interrupt you? I know we still got Little Mermaid to cover as sort of a bonus book, but
okay,
go ahead.
Do you have time for that?
Yeah, I've got time. I don't know if you were about to make another point.
Well, yeah, I did want to make one, so I didn't know how much time you had, so I was going to talk about, I did want to talk a little bit about education, but in terms of what we're talking, which, you know, building on what you're talking about, where part of what I think is good with what we should be aiming with a good education is learning how to have a self, like the techniques for understanding the self, which can come from, you know, training the mind as an essential thing. And that will allow you to become the kind of adult that you were talking about at the beginning, who has kind of the best features of Peter Pan, but has made the decision in a certain realm and knows why they made that decision. Because I think part of what you're seeing and what you're, you know, kind of attacking in Peter Pan and in Hook is that, you know, these types of adults seem to do it because they're supposed to do it. It's a duty. And that's what Peter Pan is kind of fighting against, is that duty to be a lawyer, a plumber, a doctor, whatever, be a member of society, be a socialized entity that's like good to go in society. And he doesn't want that. He wants to be this imaginative creature that could just be anything and have fun and do, you know, dream up something. And it's right there in his hand if he wants to dream it up. If he wants to fight and die, and, you know, to die is a great adventure, that's what he's, you know, going to do. And so I just think that, you know, part of our failing of kids, when I was talking about Greta Thunberg versus Petronilla, which I think are both a kind of failure, our failure of kids is not teaching them how to think, so that they can assess their own, you know, inner desires and then, you know, decide on the path that they want. This is why we have 26-year-old university students who have been in school for 7 years and they still have an undeclared major, right? And that's like common or somewhat common. And like, to some, you know, it's an exaggeration, but it's partly common. And it's like, or why people will land on history or, you know, even some humanity or, you know, underwater weaving or whatever it is, or feminist theory. And they don't know what they're going to do with that. They just like, oh, these are kind of interesting. I have to make some decision. And we're failing.
They're not selfish.
They're not selfish.
Like, they need to,
well, it takes
there
work
to be something
to be selfish.
Well, I mean, if there's something you have a passion for, and here you really want to see if you can recall your childhood to sort of see what it is that gets you going and excited. I mean, everyone needs something that like they just can't live without, that they're willing to really work in order to achieve. And when someone doesn't have that and they're also being indoctrinated with all these fakakta. that's a word.
Okay. I never heard of that.
You know, philosophical beliefs, then you're left with people that have no personal motivation outside of controlling.
They don't even know how to do it. Yeah.
We know that's a bad situation. Now, as you're talking, I was thinking Peter Pan left unsupervised and without his energy being cultivated and redirected towards a discipline of sorts, sort of ends up becoming Captain Hook, doesn't he? He ends up being this power-lusting man sort of at war with reality, but haunted by the ticking clock and wanting to control other people, but also wanting good form. It's like, I don't know. It sort of occurs to me that maybe it's no coincidence. They're both on that island.
Well, I think, like I said, I think Hook is the antipode. He is what Peter will become if he makes that choice to become an adult.
No, right. Well, I'm saying we were talking about how like first the kids are unsupervised. Like they're taught, just express yourself however you want. Then they're basically told what to do. And they're socialized, and then you see generations emerging of rebellious, angry teenagers and young adults who are burning stuff down. They're nihilistic, and that's where how I kind of see Captain Hook in a way. I don't know about burning stuff down, but yeah, like recklessly vengeful and looking to conquer and wanting to control other people. That's a big that's a big thing that comes to mind with like the Comprachico's essay and all of that. So I'm sort of drawing a sort of timeline between like Peter Pan left unsupervised, left without a sort of being taught how to think, being taught the skills for living. He ends up becoming like a, like sort of a Captain Hook type of power lusting neurotic.
Oh, you mean in the movie Hook? He becomes that in the movie Hook.
I don't mean he literally becomes that in the movie Hook. I just mean like what they sort of represent is like Hook can be seen as like what Peter Pan ends up being. So like we're looking at this island, we see like we see orphaned youth without any direction whatsoever and without any discipline whatsoever. And then you see Captain Hook. Maybe they're meant to sort of one leads to the other.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know how that's different than what I'm saying, I guess, because I'm saying that they are antipodes to each other. So that like that, that's what Peter would become if he made that choice, which I don't think he does.
I'm saying in he becomes, the book, not in the book, but he's a child in the book. I'm saying,
he's the only child. He's the only one who he's the only never, all children right, but never, him grow. That's the whole point of
look,
it.
Look, I mean, you have to suspend what you know about how time works in order to,
yeah,
you know, live in that universe of Peter Pan. But in reality, children like Peter Pan, who they've got all the energy and all the youthful spirit, but no direction and no thinking skills and all of that. Perhaps this is sort of analogous to progressive education. You know, first they're told be a kid and express yourself with no actual focus, and what you end up seeing is vindictive and power lusting pirates when they get older. That's sort of what
I think people become cynical when they get older because they're idealistic as kids, and then those ideals, you know, in terms of whether it's progressive, leftist, you know, communist, socialist ideals, and then those things don't pan out when they get older and they don't happen. And then they say, well, that's because everyone's horrible and humans are, you know, incapable of any kind of, you know, idealism. So they become the pirate because of cynicism, essentially, because their ideals as the Greta Thunberg, when she's 35 and realizes her life has been wasted, which it will be, which is the tragedy of Greta Thunberg, is, you know, her parents are letting that happen and they're evil for letting that, for doing that to her. I think truly evil. And like, you know, she's going to be 35 and she'll probably get super cynical and she'll probably get really angry and mad and hateful, you know, or she'll have like a revelation. So there is free will. So she has, maybe she'll read some Ayn Rand and she'll learn that there's something wrong with the theory. Although she's so committed to this psychologically, it'd be really hard.
She is young, you know, so she's young. Wouldn't that be some great PR for objectivism to have someone so outspoken and, and famous actually end up seeing the light? That would be magnificent. Yeah. But then the public would watch her go through the various motions of like misunderstanding or trying to know too much too fast, and then she's wagging her finger at the world in the name of objectivism.
Yeah, she's
now we got a new set of problems. But I mean, when I talk about how like the sort of Peter Pan type turns into Captain Hook, like a vindictive, angry teenager, like, or young adult, like I'm basically saying, yeah, that cynicism is a part of that, isn't it? Once a blissful child realizes the world is not what I was told. That is kind of where you see a lot of the adolescent rage. So,
well, you were talking about seeing the light in The Little Mermaid. She's laying at the bottom of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved how she looks up and she sees the sun as kind of like this, and she falls in love with the sun in a sense, as this big red, you know, flower that she's seeing through the portal of the sea, and that it becomes like she wants to be up there with that world that feels the warmth of the sun. So you wanted to make a comparison between Peter Pan or you said you had things to say to connect them.
Yeah. I thought we could definitely throw this in as a bonus book review. And there is stuff that I think we can relate to Peter Pan. So this is not a Disney movie, folks. This is not a Disney movie. It's a rich, deep, sad story.
Yeah, this is not the Disney. This is the Hans Christian Andersen version.
Yeah, Hans Christian Andersen. This is a translation. I don't know what language it was originally. I don't know what his name sounds Norwegian to me, the S-E-N at the end, but I don't know what language he wrote in.
Dutch or something?
So this girl who I don't think we Danish. Know her name. Oh, he's Danish. Okay. Yeah. Well, close enough. how dare you compare us to them? People are saying around the world.
yeah, sorry.
No. I don't think we actually learn her name. She's just the little mermaid, the Little Mermaid. So she's in love with the statue, first and foremost. So various treasures had reached the bottom of the ocean from shipwrecks. You know, anytime a ship would crash and sink, various treasures, and in this case, a statue of a handsome prince, landed. And this mermaid, very value-driven, very idealistic, she's drawn to this statue, and she spends her time in the garden with this statue. The mermaid also has a beautiful singing voice, very gifted in that. And ends up, once she turns 15, like all mermaids, she's permitted to swim up to the surface and take a look at the world up there. So she waits. Her older sisters get to go and then return, and then she asks them questions. Oh, what's it like? What's it like? She just can't wait to get to go up there. Finally, she turns 15. She swims up to the surface of the earth, to the surface of the sea, and sees the earth, sees the island, and sees the boat, where she sees a real life prince on that boat and falls in love with him. Mm-hmm. I think the ship ends up crashing, and she ends up saving the life of this prince, bringing him to the shore. And then when she sees other people coming, she escapes. She swims back to the, and she watches, she sees a princess of some neighboring kingdom, ends up, quote, discovering him there. And he wakes up and he thinks this princess saved his life. Now Ariel goes back down to the bottom of the ocean, and she says, I need to become
Little Mermaid, not Ariel.
Right. Sorry. Little Mermaid says, I need to be a human. Yeah. She goes, I need to, get back up there and fall in love with this prince. I need to have this. So she goes to, the witch, the one woman with the power to give her what she wants. And the witch says, okay. So first the mermaid swims through danger just to get to the witch.
Yeah.
It's very dangerous and life-threatening, the various plants or whatever she needs to swim through to get to this witch. And the witch says, you trade your voice for the ability to be human. And being human means you get to live forever. So you see, like, the Christian mythology is blended with this mermaid mythology. So humans are presumed to be immortal in that once they die, they go to heaven. But the mermaids, however, they don't go to heaven. They are, God does not wish to bring them close to himself, but he does let them live for 300 years. So basically she's trading a long life for a much shorter, but yet infinite one. But also she trades her voice. She trades her beautiful singing voice and ability to speak.
And do you remember what else though? So like, what happens when she gets her legs?
They hurt. Like walking feels like jab.
Yeah, like when it's described when her legs initially split, it's like a sword slashing her. And then when she walks, it's like she's walking on swords. So it's very brutal. And her feet, when they're climbing, she's climbing with the prince at one point, and her feet are bloody, right? Because it's just so painful. And she's not used to walking, I think is the reason. But yeah, I'm just saying there's a lot of pain, like real pain involved. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but there's just so much pain, and I wanted to stress in this version, it's not like the Disney version where it's very innocent, of course. Like, this is a fairy tale, and kids would have, read this. This is for kids, but it was so brutal.
She needs to like live in physical pain. She has no voice.
Yeah.
But she still takes it for her one chance to be both immortal as well as have the prince.
Yeah.
So she goes, the prince ends up finding her and inviting her to live as a servant, I think, in his castle, like a pet, with his family, like a pet basically.
Yeah.
And he doesn't love her back. Wishes she could speak to him and say, I'm the one who saved you. Maybe that would, change his mind, but he doesn't love her back. And he even tells her like, oh, you're like a pet to me. You're like a sister, whatever he tells her. And at one point, the ultimate insult, well, when his family negotiates with the neighboring kingdom for him to meet their daughter, and then if they get along, marry that princess, the prince tells the mermaid, he says something like, yeah, I don't even like her. I'd even marry you sooner, or something like that. Like, it was like, it was a slight against her, or like, if if I can't have her, or he tells her, like, I just really want to find the girl who saved my life, he says.
Yeah.
You know, he goes, like, if I can't have her, then it doesn't matter. I'd even marry you if I can't find that one girl. So yeah. But even through all of this, the mermaid never stops longing for him. She is just, she does not like take it personally and to the point of anger. She just is hoping and hoping and hoping. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up meeting the princess from the neighboring kingdom. And he remembers her. He says, oh, you are the one who found me when the ship sank. Mm-hmm. And he thinks she saved his life and falls in love with her. Therefore marries her. And as everyone's celebrating, the mermaid is heartbroken, and they're on the boat, celebrating both kingdoms. The houses of both kingdoms are on this boat celebrating, and the mermaid sees her sisters come to the surface, and their hair is short. They said, we traded our hair as part of a deal with the witch to get you this deal. You can return to being a mermaid, but you have to kill the prince. You have to kill him. That's part of the deal. And the mermaid enters his sleeping quarters. She sees him with his bride asleep, looking blissful, looking happy. And she says, no, I'm not going to do it. She ends up jumping off the ledge to her own demise and drowning. And then her spirit is lifted up by this band of sisters
air
sisters. What they do is they go around making the world better for people. They help plants pollinate, which benefits people. They do all various things. They blow the wind in a way that people benefit from. So they go around sort of helping out people. And if they do a good job, then at some point they get to go to heaven too. So they need to earn their way into heaven. And the book finally ends with saying that if boys and girls do what their parents wish, if they stay clean and they go to bed on time and they're good kids,
your synopsis.
Then the air sisters get to heaven sooner. But if kids misbehave, then it takes longer for these air sisters to get to heaven. So it sort of ends with this message to the boys and girls, like, so you better be a good kid or the Little Mermaid is going to be stuck in purgatory flying around aimlessly for longer. So the ending was kind of silly, but it's a rich story, and it's pretty short. I would recommend reading this.
Oh, yeah, it's very short. I mean, I think I read it in like an hour, less than an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not that long. I mean, it's a fairy tale. It's and one thing that I think is interesting is you're talking about immortal versus mortal, but also there's this dichotomy between the land of beauty of 300 years of being happy, that is the land of the world of the mermaids, and versus the hardship, the shipwreck, the misery, the short-lived life of the humans. But the humans, of course, are recompensed with immortality for this, which is, again, all this is very Christian. You know, so the Little Mermaid asks, why weren't we given an immortal soul? I would gladly give up my 300 years if I could be a human being only for a day and later share in that heavenly realm. And then the old lady says, which is the grandmother, the king's mother, you must not think about that. We fare much more happily and are much better off than the folk up there. Right. And then you would float when you die at 300, you just float up into the sea. But I think there's that show where it's like, you know, so it's also telling the story to like humans in 1800s, right? That, hey, look, yeah, your parents probably died, or you lost three kids. Your brother died. You have a friend that died of plague, you know, this happened, you're going to die in a couple years, but you have this short, miserable, brutish life and it sucks, but you're going to go to heaven. The alternative is to live like this mermaid and you could have the beauty. You could see the beauty from afar and you could live in this wonderful land where, you know, you could see things and enjoy that, I guess, and live for a long time, but you're going to die and turn into foam if you do that. Unless you sacrifice yourself, because she sacrifices herself at the end. That's when she jumps in the foam. She could have done the opposite, but because she's a good moral person, you know, she's gone up there and she's fallen in love with him. She sacrifices herself, and that's rewarded by the Air sister turning her. And she doesn't even go to heaven. She goes into like a place where she can wait to, or something,
and then,
like,
and then go to heaven. But I think, I think that the decision she makes at the end, it can be interpreted as altruism, or it can be interpreted as
she loves him. Yeah.
She loves him. She values him and won't kill him. So I think the author is cleverly, as often people do, they package, you know, altruism with its opposite, as though they're one and the same. So if you reject one, you reject both.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I guess the
mermaid. Well, but the Disneyland, the Disney movie has the happy ending.
I know that much. But yeah.
What I'm saying is it's possible, but the fact that he chose to make it so she does die, and it's, you know, she's expecting to die. Like, she's expecting this to be the end, and then she gets this kind of happy ending, and that's because she chooses to, like, not try to pursue the man, to let the woman, like, Ariel in the movie fights for her love, right? She fights for Eric, or whatever his name is, who's kind of a doofus. And, you know, so anyway, there is a difference between the two, and I think that it's a better, that ending of Ariel fights for it, and then he fights for her by fighting the godmother, and then that's how together they become, you know, humans together. Or, you know, she becomes a full human with her voice. She gets her voice back. Whereas in Hans, you know, the Danish guy, nope. You don't get any of that. Sorry, yeah. Ariel. We sink you and you get to stay in purgatory for 300 years.
Yeah, it's
so she's still up there.
Story. Mm-hmm. So it is nonetheless a story about value pursuit. Yeah. About, you know, somebody who wants something and is willing to fight for it, to suffer for it, and ultimately not to attain it, but would rather go that route than just, you know, stay with the life that she was handed. I guess the mermaids in sort of like represent like earthly life in a way, ironically, because they're not on Earth. Well, they're closer. They're on Earth, but just they've got also water surrounding them. But they're, you know, they're like pagan gods almost, other than the fact that they're mortal, but they live longer. They spend their time singing. They have no obligation to God. They won't get to heaven either, but they have no contract with God whatsoever. They're celebrating, they're eating, they're singing. And this, this one mermaid has something that she wants, I guess. She wants to be human because of what it means to her. Like, so what is it she wants? What is it that a human prince can offer her that a fellow merman cannot?
Well, I don't know. There's not much said about the merman except, but I do think that there's like, so the garden plots. So you say that they're earthly, which I agree with, because each sister has a garden plot and they each, you know, they plant it with their own thing from sunken treasures. And like, so most of them though, it's just random things that they got together, which is in the movie, in the Disney movie, Ariel's plot, which she's by herself, she doesn't have sisters, and that is all this random stuff, right? And this is the song, you know, Part of Your World, that she wants to be part of their world, which I do think is a beautiful song, actually, because it's all about, you know, wanting to dance and to live life and to walk in the sun and to enjoy, relish existence, which, you know, in her darker, at the bottom of the dark ocean, she doesn't get to as much. And in here, you kind of see that in what she loves is, you pointed out, the marble statue, and that becomes like a god to her. And the same thing with the big sun. So all her garden plot is the basically little, what was it? I'm trying to find it right here. Like she grew flowers, which were as red as the sun itself. And then it kind of, and then she has the statue in the center of that. That's it. And her sisters have all the random stuff. So the point is, I think that kind of grows her desire. She wants to become 15 quicker than the other girls. The other girls do various versions of, they just kind of sit there and look around. One of them is a little bit bolder. She goes a little farther in and, ooh, look at the cities. But they're perfectly satisfied with where they are. In fact, one of the darker elements that you didn't quite mention was that the sisters actually enjoyed in a weird sense the dead men that fell to the bottom, because they would sing, you know, they were the sirens. They're kind of talked like that, where they sing to the sailors, and then some of the sailors will crash, and then they'll come down, but they come down as dead men. You know, they can't survive, obviously. Mm. And but Ariel, or the Little Mermaid's character, doesn't want that. Like, she starts to worry about that, and that's why she saves the prince, because there's even a moment when he crashes and she's like, ooh, he'll be with me. And then she says, oh no, ooh, he will be dead. So then she brings him up, they go with the waves, they go there, and then she runs away. You know, when the people come, and that's what you're talking about. But I think they're, you know, it's just what makes her different is she was like this, you know, she's described as an unusual child, quiet and wistful. And part of it, I think, is, you know, there does seem to be a connection between quiet, wistful children, even maybe the Peter Pan we're talking about, where there's like a desire for something, right? Their desire is more intense than other people. And for her, she has this desire that desire becomes trans, like it starts off as an imaginative for this, you know, figure that isn't real, this marble figure, but then she sees him in real life and then she wants him. Right. She sees the prince when she's like, you know, looking in his cabin, he's six at his 16th birthday and they're firing off fireworks to celebrate. And then she falls in love with him and then she saves him and hopes that he saves her or, you know, loves her, but he doesn't. Right. Cause, it's not a happy ending in that sense.
It's not happy at any stage of the story. It's unhappy. Yeah, it's just like there's just sadness any way you look at it. And like the sort of pursuit of values is sort of shown to be basically pointless in a way. Like, there's definitely a malevolence to this story, but it still depicts that passionate pursuit of something or longing for something that, again, can be abstracted and applied in a way that's not negative, that's not futile. So maybe the sort of Christian streak that the author has is sort of informs the way he sees this sort of the failure of this mermaid's attempt to go out and get something.
Yeah, to actually achieve it. But the flip side is that she does, you know, work toward it. She does make sacrifices. She goes through the dark forest. She gives up her tongue, you know, like they actually cut it off. They don't describe the cutting, but they cut it off, her tongue off. Right. Mm-hmm. And the witch doesn't lie to her. She doesn't deceive her. She says, look, this is what you want. This is what it's going to cost. You're going to have to give up your tongue. You're going to have to have a sword cut you. It'll feel like that. Now, what will you get in return? You're going to have the stress of her form. She's going to have fine form. She's going to be sexy, basically, you know, beautiful body, but she's not going to have the voice. She's not going to have any of the things that might be seductive. And that it's in Christian's world, Hans Christian Andersen's world, is a failing formula, apparently, for love, at least. But again, so that's really like the last two paragraphs where that stuff happens. Most of the book is this beautiful underworld where she lives, or this resplendent with life underworld that is like, you know, again, this 300 years, and then you turn into sea foam, which is what the humans see. Like, and there's even a moment when the sisters, right, when she's in human form, Little Mermaid, she's looking over and her sisters are there. And then the other men on the ship come, and then the sisters disappear and turn into sea foam. So it is, you know, I think what Andersen is doing here is like, he's taking these myths that we know, and he's like, you know, making it into this story about this mermaid who tried to become a human, but the cost was too big in his sense. I think that's the Christian element, is she's not capable. But the nice thing about the story is her desire that being human, living among those things. And this is what the Disney movie, I think, does well, is like in the Part of Your World song, which you could watch on YouTube for free. you know, she's like looking at little what she calls like whatchamacallit, and she's in love with all of the little gadgets. Like, how she says, like, how can anything bad be in a world that has these things? Right. And she's in love with all these things that she sees, mirrors, forks and spoons and candelabra and all these types of inventions. And that's part of the wondrous world above her. And, you know, we could also think of this as like animal becoming man. Right. And that this is, you know, that transition and the desire for that. You know, I think there's a lot of that in this story as well.
Yeah. And, there is something sort of a hard truth about life itself. You know, when you're young and you're infatuated, you could easily say, I'll trade anything for one chance at this person that I'm infatuated with. And then you very quickly just kind of see it's just not happening. And maybe your infatuation is part of the reason it's not happening. Like it's a handicap. And so in a way, like Ariel, the Little Mermaid sort of learns this lesson. And one of the lessons you can actually abstract from this whole thing is that wanting to be a human, could have its proper reasons, but your primary value cannot be the love of another person that you're not currently with yet. You know, you need to have something that does not rely on another person's, you know, affection, right? So if the Little Mermaid had, let's say, fallen in love with the architecture of the city and said, I want to build my own version of that. That would be an interesting route to go. But it's there's a very, very much like this adolescent love component with sort of a childlike fascination, which, again, someone could say, well, it teaches you the harsh lesson. Actually, Maddox did a video about Hans Christian, about the Japanese cartoon movie based on the Hans Christian Andersen book, where Maddox talks about how much better that version is than the Disney version. But what he takes away is that because that's what life is. You don't always get what you want and you are likely to fail and all that. I mean, yes, that is all true. But what point was I going to make? It's that here's the point. The point is that longing, that passion, that dedication to a value is not to be discarded. It just means this particular goal was not it. Not now. Let's say in the mermaid's case, the prince.
Yeah,
that wasn't it now. But the other things she could have wanted as a human could have been very feasible anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that there's some, you know, she makes a childish, in a sense, a childish leap to form. And I think that the emphasis on her form, right? So it's not her voice, and it's not, she has no reason in the story, of course, to love him other than his form, rather than he looks good. Like, he's unconscious when she sees him. Now, she does see that he seems kind of nice because he shakes people's hands or whatever, but she like has no connection with him other than looking. So he's basically, you know, this is the role of like, with art, you can, you know, dream of the world in the future that you desire. And then, but you have to actually work to make that happen in real life. And, there was a Leonard Peikoff radio show years ago, obviously, where someone wrote in, and she was a single woman, I think in her 30s or something. And she was talking about like, why would she need to find a romantic sexual relationship? Because she gets all her pleasures that she needs in her mind from paintings and art and things like that. And he said, no, because it's not real, right? Like, and so you want the real. And I think the mistake that the Little Mermaid makes is that she falls in love purely with the form. And she doesn't know the real stuff yet. And she doesn't care about that. Mm-hmm. And she's willing to do all the sacrifices, not for the worthy prince, but for the unworthy prince. And
it all starts with a statue at the bottom of the sea.
That, which is good, but she makes the mistake of like, okay, it's right there. It's good enough. I'm going to, you know, but she has there's no realness to it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that I think is the mistake. So for me, although, you know, Andersen might be critiquing, you know, the art itself, where it's like, we want this ideal, we try to achieve it and it doesn't achieve, right? That could be very well what I think that probably is what Anderson is trying to say. And I'm, you know, inputting my own personal views.
Well, he could be saying that, but his error could help us sort of correct his error. So yes, yeah. that passion that the mermaid has, just like with that, the youthful spirit of Peter Pan, it speaks to something very real that should be directed towards real life pursuits that you learn how to pursue as you get older. And in doing so, age becomes a friend. You know, reality is on your side and maturity is on your side because you get better and more capable and more independent as time passes. So,
And age is a good thing. It comes with, you have more things to remember because you've experienced more things, right? Versus Peter Pan, who remembers nothing. So he has no reality to build upon. Like at 35, I have more reality to build upon than I did at 25 because I've had more instances in reality to interact with. Now, I think so we could start wrapping up, but I did want you to talk to me before we left about why you wanted to, or any kind of connection. Like, why did you choose this one? You said you had, you said you could connect. I was just curious what that was. Besides, they're both children's literature, I think.
Yeah, I read Peter Pan because, like I said, I've been revisiting early life influences, and Peter Pan sort of stands out as like one of the most important stories from when I was a kid, and particularly a cartoon series that was on TV, which I was watching. And then The Little Mermaid, I think what made me want to read it is that I knew there was a very kind of dark side to the book, and I wanted to take the opportunity while I was revisiting these old stories to like read that. I guess I was curious to see. And then like, what's the connection between the two? Well, okay, in one respect, this is not the deepest point, but it is still, I think, a point that I sort of see Peter Pan, the book, as sort of a little bit poking fun at adventure stories and at fairy tales and at all that. Like I said, you got fairies, mermaids, pirates, Indians, and like talking animals or something, like all on the same island, like following each other around. It's like silly in a way. It's sort of like someone like, as in the turn of the century, you've got like mankind now in this new city and this new sort of setting where nature, you know, the nature is no longer a threat. And we're very clear that mermaids don't exist. But, you know, like kind of what does it all mean now? What do we do with this? And the Peter Pan book sort of plays around with all of these types of characters. So it was interesting to see. And because in a certain respect, perhaps Peter Pan would not contain mermaids in it, but for The Little Mermaid. I mean, we don't really know. And so it was kind of interesting to see, like, what are some of the influences on Peter Pan in the first place? I sort of see Peter Pan as sort of a lampooning of adventure books at this point, based on what I know. So it's sort of like a parody or whatever the word is. It's sort of, it's taking images and ideas and characters and stuff from earlier literature and sort of having fun with it and reorganizing it and sort of in a way showing it the absurdity of it all. So it was interesting to kind of see what is it that J.M. Barrie is sort of poking fun at, if he is in fact poking fun. And I guess that's the connection. The other connection is, again, that youthful drive. You know, what does youth mean? Is it all silly? So, you know, in Peter Pan, you've got Peter who, you know, his bliss comes with a short memory and general incompetence with life. And when the kids do return to London and grow up, they become unhappy with what life as an adult is like. And then in The Little Mermaid, you've got a youth, more like a little bit older, but still young and idealistic and passionate, pursuing something and failing. So there's sort of a common theme there, in a way, sort of this sort of a malevolent streak with both, kind of like the universe is not hospitable to people that have that youthful spirit and longing. And I disagree with that idea. I think properly understood, that youthful energy is meant to be like serve as a launch pad to then follow a rational course and succeed and enjoy your success.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I mean, I definitely see that there's definitely those connections to the series. I think there are other to each other. I mean, I take them both to be basically fairy tales, and Peter Pan is just a more expanded, more detailed fairy tale. But, I think it's a proper novel, actually. It is a novel, but it's based on these, you know, it's all in the realm of these fairy tales, you know, the Grimm fairy tales, the Andersen fairy tales, and just, you know, going all the way back to Greek literature and, you know, the nymphs and the forest fairies and the, you know.
You don't see like kind of a cynical side to Peter Pan, like he's kind of poking fun at that whole universe. I sort of see it as kind of a lampooning of the whole thing. Maybe that's just how my mind tends to operate, and that's kind of what I do with a lot of.
But why lampooning? Cultures. Why the that? Do you, what specifically do you take for that part?
The fact that there's every type of imaginary character all on one island, so it's not like. It's an island with mermaids. It's like there's all these different things happening at once, and they're all chasing each other in a circle like that, right? They're all following one another. Each one's checking for the one in back of them, and the pirates are – it's just seems – you know, Captain Hook is obviously a goofball, so he's not this – he's not this scary force to be reckoned with. He's this insecure, goofy pirate. I just it seems like in a way like the author is sort of – poking fun at adventure stories. I don't know if, as well as fairy tales.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess I just didn't see that in the book as much as you are. Mm-hmm. I thought of it as like, it was a, you know, a celebration of those types of things. Like that, this is the land that the Lost Boys go to that, you know, it's all the stuff of the stuff that dreams are made of type thing. Like this is the world of imagination. And I found it, you know, personally resplendent to go see this, that, and to think of it as a real place that you can go visit, which is how I think of the world of imagination, that this is a place you can actually go, the creations of men's minds. So mermaids were a creation of men's minds to convey certain ideas and stories, but they're also just enjoyable. Right. Same thing with pirates and, you know, me playing pirates and cowboys and Indians as a kid and bank robbers. And, you know, what was it? Robbers. And we're not supposed to say Indians and
a little too late for that.
Cowboys. We're not supposed to say cowboys and Indians anymore. I got in trouble for that once trying to do a class on cowboys and Indians.
Ooh, yeah.
They don't let you do that anymore. I have to call them Native Americans. but anyway, so yeah, I mean, I guess I just took it that way. So the cynical or the poking fun at thing, I guess I didn't quite see it, but I could see how, sure, there's a little bit of that. I mean, I even saw like there was, Samuel Taylor Coleridge's, Rime of the Ancient Mariner and how, when they shoot Wendy, she is like a bird, just like the albatross that's shot in that story. And I thought of it is exactly like that, and that he's kind of playing in this world, and he's very much informing kids in 1904, 1911 of this world of the imagination that happened before. Yeah. So that's all. I just don't think I saw it quite. That's not to say that it's not there at all, what you're saying. I just didn't quite see it as much. Mm-hmm. That's all. So,
yeah. Interesting stuff. Well, here we are, a couple of grown men talking about Little Mermaid and Peter Pan.
But, well, I love it. And any concluding thoughts? Cause I would like, there's one concluding thought I'd like to say, and then we can sign off. But did you have anything before I did
that? Not at the moment, but
okay. What do you have? So my last thought is that I think there's, you know, value in categorizing children's literature as serious, you know, like what's the serious literature of children's literature. Obviously you can have silly nonsense that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but I think stuff like The Little Mermaid, Peter Pan, I think there's a lot of, you know, good, you know, children's lit out there. And the way I think of it, that I think Peter Pan and Little Mermaid fit into, is it's about the coming into the world of justice. Fundamentally, it's about the, you know, the, like the Princess and the Frog, the birth of the king in a sense, in terms of the birth of the good action. And adult serious literature tends to be about the sad death of kings. So it's when they do something wrong and that leads to bad things. And in this case, you know, for instance, with Peter Pan, you have Wendy, who's the surrogate mother of everybody, and she's taking on that role. When her brothers start to forget their real mothers, she does the right thing, which I think is indicative of the moral of this as a, you know, kid's story, as children's lit, by saying, we need to go home. Like, this is the time that they have to go home. And then they're kidnapped and Peter Pan, of course, comes to save them. But I think it's that decision that's the climax and that leads them to home and to having mothers, because J.M. Barrie, as you said at the very beginning, was interested, you know, that was important to him. And I think the importance of having a mother, and that's kind of how I saw the coming into the world of justice. In Anderson, of course, it's a Christian justice. So the justice is when you, you know, do the right thing, you don't murder someone just because you didn't get what you wanted, which is, you know, mating with the prince, you don't murder him, right? And you'll be rewarded for that. So that's why I wanted just to end with that. I think children's literature is very valuable, even for adults, because it can, you know, one, we are indoctrinated with this stuff and sometimes it's not right. And sometimes we have to question it, but it is embedded in us, just like you saw those stories. So it's really important, I think, as you get older, to analyze them and to think about them, to say, I don't agree with all of that. That's a problem. And yet I'm, you know, my compass is built on Peter Pan and on, you know, whatever other, you know, kid stories that, you know, hundreds of kid stories that you saw as a kid.
So. You know, I'm reminded of Ayn Rand's essay about Buck Rogers, the spaceman, is it?
I think so. Astronaut.
And how important it is for when a child is, you know, admires a character like that, not to shame him for it, but to help him abstract from that story. And so he can become his own version of Buck Rogers. You know, as a kid, I would like fantasize about being like Peter Pan and having not only the ability to fly, but to being basically God and being able to do anything. But that would not be satisfying, you know, having omniscience or omnipotent. It's just, then what, you know, what do you do with that? Just like, you know, I also thought at one time as a kid, like, oh, if I could just watch as much TV as I want, I'll be set. And then guess what? I can. And it's not it.
Yep.
You need to have something that you're passionate about doing, creating, have it some sort of creative
purpose.
Yep. So, you know, it's easy to become cynical about these children's stories if you don't properly abstract from them and integrate these valuable lessons and sort of hold on to the good feeling that you got from them and properly direct that energy towards something that is very, very realistic and attainable.
I mean, that's a good place to end. That was great. Thank you.
Great.
All right. Good talk. Thanks for coming, Raka.
Thanks for having me, and good luck with the series.
All right.